Our reading today is the concluding prayer from Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address as President of the United States. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its few spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made to disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
In my sermon on idolatry in Unitarian Universalism a few weeks ago, I defined idolatry as mistaking something that is not ultimate for that which is. As we begin today to think about what idolatry looks like in the United States today, I think a really good place to start is to ask ourselves, what is truly ultimate about this country? To put it a little differently, what is the most basic principle or value upon which this nation is founded? I have a thought on that. But I'll begin by sharing a few things I don't think are central to who we are as a nation. One of those is belief in God. Even though there was a lot of God talk among the founders, and it's been there ever since, but the wall of separation between church and state means, I think, that you can be an atheist and still be a good American citizen. Notwithstanding the "in God we trust" on our coins, belief in God is not the ultimate principle of this nation. I'd also say that the flag is not what's ultimate about the United States. This seems obvious, but I don't think it necessarily is. The flag is a symbol, a powerful, stirring symbol, and yet it is just a symbol. To me, the constitutional amendment that's been proposed to ban flag burning is a great example of idolatry. It's treating a symbol as the thing itself, as that ultimate principle. And this one's a little harder, but I would also say the Constitution is not the ultimate concern or ultimate principle of the United States. It's hard because that's what our government's based on, but I actually think what's ultimate about this nation goes deeper than the Constitution even. So what is it in my view? I think what's ultimate about the United States is contained in the Declaration of Independence in one line. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To me, that line is the foundational principle of our nation. It expresses the hope and the promise of the United States. To borrow a phrase from the late Unitarian Universalist minister Forrest Church, it expresses the American creed. Or in the civil rights leader Roger Wilkins' words, it's like the Big Bang in the physics of the American experiment. Everything flows from that line. Most importantly, I think, as Lincoln said in the words that Marty started the service with, I think that the Declaration of Independence has been, this line, has been a rebuke for this country now for 235 years, calling us to do better when we have fallen short of that great principle. We can use those words to get a sense of how our nation is doing. So Lincoln understood this, and he used that phrase from the Declaration to fix the greatest error, the most tragic error in the Constitution, the preservation of slavery. The suffragists used the spirit of this great principle to rebuke the too narrow understanding that the language itself in that sentence might convey that all men are created equal. The suffragists said, no, all people, males and females, are created equal. That's the deeper spirit of that line. And then in the 1950s and 60s, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement used that foundational principle from the Declaration to help call us to greater racial justice and equality. To me, this foundational principle, especially as it was understood and expanded by Lincoln, by King, by the suffragists, is truly brilliant. To me, it is one of the great hopes of the world, and it is the reason that I continue to count myself an ardent patriot, even as I question how well we are living up to this principle. To me, one of the brilliant aspects of this principle is those words, pursuit of. This principle does not guarantee us happiness. I don't think anyone can, any government can. Indeed, I don't think any God can. But what it does is it guarantees us the right to pursue happiness. When you're counted as three-fifths of a person, as the slaves were in the Constitution, and you're denied the right to work where you want, to live where you want, even to live with your family, then clearly you do not have the right to pursue happiness. When you are not allowed to vote, or not given equal opportunity or equal pay for equal work because of your gender, then you don't have the opportunity to fully realize happiness. This American Creed reminds us of this, and it continues to push us to do better. I need here, though, to add a word of caution about the pursuit of happiness. This right in itself can become a false idol when it is taken as a license to cheat or to abuse or to devalue other people. So this is where another concept of the founders comes into play, and I think is really important, the concept of the common good. The right to pursue happiness is not a blank check to do whatever you want. None of us has the right to pursue happiness to the detriment of others or the common good. So the idea of the common good balances this individual right to pursue happiness with a moral responsibility. A moral responsibility to our fellow Americans and to the common good. With freedom comes responsibility. Well, if these words from the Declaration of Independence capture what is truly ultimate about our nation, then the question today is, what are we substituting for this ultimate principle? And I thought today that I would present a list of false idols in the United States today. But in thinking about it, I found that there was one that seems so overwhelmingly important from the beginning of our nation to now, stretching into the future, I am quite sure that this is the one I want to talk about today. And that one is money. I would guess this is not a shocking revelation to anyone in this room. And I want to say that money in and of itself is not a false idol. It becomes a false idol when it becomes the most important concern in our life. The pursuit of money is the most important concern, and it drives us to harm others and to harm the common good. Unchecked greed can cause us to lose our moral compass. This week I can't help but wonder if that is part of what happened at Penn State, part of why so many people apparently made such a terrible mistake in not reporting those crimes to the police. According to the Business of College Sports, last year Penn State's football program was the third most profitable in the United States, earning more than $50 million. I just can't help but wonder if a sense of greed, a sense of putting that profit too much in the center, was part of why some people lost their moral compass. Greed can cause us to do things contrary to the common good. And when greed is rampant, it can corrode liberty. I think that in our nation's history, greed can be especially corrosive to liberty when it results in excessive concentrations of wealth. This is because excessive concentrations of wealth undermine equality and opportunity for all. And what's more, usually when there's an excessive concentration of wealth, also going along with it is an excessive concentration of political power and influence. John Adams warned about this way back in the beginning of our country. He warned that when economic power becomes, in his words, concentrated in a few hands, then political power flows to those possessors and away from the citizens, ultimately resulting in an oligarchy or tyranny. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, 100 years after Adams, had the same concern when he said, "We can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or we can have democracy. We cannot have both." Concern about excessive concentration of wealth in this country is nothing new. Greed run amok, and its resulting concentration of wealth and power, I think, has caused disastrous results in especially two eras in our nation's history. The first of those was slavery, and this isn't always the way we think about slavery, but part of what fueled slavery was the greed of slaveholders and the greed of those who made money from the slave industry. In our Unitarian history, we lift up the abolitionists who were Unitarians. But the truth is, there were many Unitarians in Boston and in New England who either supported slavery or turned a blind eye to it. Why? Because they were making money. They and the slaveholders in the South used their economic and political power to preserve slavery. A second era where greed ran amok, I think, was the age between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Great Depression. This is when Justice Brandeis's quote, this is where it came from. "The progressive movement first, and then the New Deal second, were responses to excessive income disparity in that era. I would also say in a different way, unintentionally, another response was the Great Depression. Greed run amok turned out not to be good for the country, but also not good for some of the people who had vast sums of wealth." You may be able to see where I'm going with this, because I think there is a lot of evidence today that we are in a new era of greed run amok, and with the excessive concentration of wealth that can breed. The recent nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office report has been widely noted that after-tax income of the richest 1% of the American population over the past 30 years rose nearly 300%, while the income of wage earners, hourly wage earners, declined by 7%. The top 1% share of the economic pie in our country grew from 9% over this period to 23%. Combine that with the influence, the rising influence of powerful lobbies, the demise of campaign finance reform, and the fact that nearly 50% of Congress members are millionaires, whereas their percentage in the American population is 1%, all that leads to the danger of plutocracy, rule by the wealthy. John Adams' warning should give us profound disquiet. I don't mean today to demonize everyone who is very wealthy. There are many very wealthy people who care deeply about the common good and who show that with their generosity. There are many among the very wealthy, like Bill Gates Sr. and Warren Buffett, who also feel like something's not right with this kind of concentration of wealth. I have to tell you that to me, something feels out of whack. It feels out of whack to me, for instance, that our Wisconsin legislature's Joint Finance Committee voted this past week to cut Medicaid by $225 million. The Post Crescent reports that this would result in the loss of health care coverage for some 65,000 adults, poor adults and children in our state. Does this help the common good? And does it make sense nationwide to have this kind of cut across the board while at the same time we are simultaneously preserving or, as some would have, even extending tax cuts for the very wealthy, especially when these tax cuts clearly over the past 30 years are part of why we have a growing income disparity? I don't think it makes sense. But it does seem like there are some folks who think that helping the very rich get richer should be our top priority, even though there doesn't seem to be evidence that that raises everybody's vote. Brings us to the Occupy Wall Street movement. If slavery begat the abolitionist movement and the Gilded Age begat the progressive movement, is it possible that this current out-of-whack state is begetting the Occupy Wall Street movement? Who knows today if we are witnessing a movement beginning which will have the kind of profound impact that the progressives and the abolitionists had, or if we're seeing an ineffective response that will be forgotten in a couple of years. I actually worry that the latter is the case. I'm not sure that the Occupy movement is focused enough or disciplined enough or politically savvy enough or in it for the long haul enough to make a lasting difference. I also worry that it may portray all the top 1% as demonic. But who knows? It's too early to tell. We're just in the midst of this. I would say this, though, that even if this movement quickly fades, the Occupy movement has already made an important contribution by spotlighting the dangers of excessively concentrated wealth. And I am grateful for this. I am grateful for the people who have been camping out in our cities, that they have taken it upon themselves to try to change things, to try to breathe new life into the American creed. The truth is that they, and you, and me, all of us in this country, do have an opportunity to make a difference. It is we who can help nudge this nation away from an idolatry of money toward more perfectly fulfilling the American creed. The American story is, as it always has been and always will be, unfinished and imperfect, and the next chapter is in our hands. I applaud the Occupy movement for understanding this and acting upon it. In thinking about the sermon this week, I ran across a poem by Langston Hughes, the great African-American writer and social activist. This poem powerfully reflects the particular moment he wrote at 1938. The Great Depression was still going. Labor unrest was occurring across the country, and of course, the scourge of racism was continuing. And I think Hughes's poem captures that moment well, but I also think it speaks to this moment. In the poem, Hughes remarkably blends a blistering critique of the United States and an abiding hope that our nation's promise may yet be fulfilled. He unmasks idolatries like greed and at the same time reminds us of the dream of creating a land of opportunity for all. It is a poem that makes me feel convicted and inspired and hopeful. And so I think it's a good note to end the sermon on today. So here is a slightly abbreviated version of the poem read by James Earl Jones.
Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dream. Let it be that great strong land of love, where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog and mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, of gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker, sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean. Hungry yet today, despite the dream. Beaten yet today, O pioneers. I am the man who never got ahead. The poorest worker bartered through the years. Yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world, while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turn, that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I am the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore, and Poland's plain, and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand, I came to build the homeland of the free. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. America will be.